From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Beyond Any Measure by Carl Edward Wagner. In the dream, I find myself alone in a room. I hear musical chimes, a sort of music box tune, and I look around to see where the sound is coming from. I'm in a bedroom. Heavy curtains close off the window, and it's quite dark, but I can sense that the furnishings are entirely antique, late Victorian, I think. There's a large four-poster bed with its curtains drawn. Beside the bed is a small night table upon which a candle is burning. It is from here that the music seems to be coming. I walk across the room toward the bed, and as I stand beside it, I see a gold watch resting on the night table next to the candlestick. The music box tune is coming from the watch, I realize. It's one of those old pocket watch affairs with a case that opens. The case is open now, and I see that the watch's hands are almost at midnight. I sense that on the inside of the watch case there will be a picture, and I pick up the watch to see whose picture it is. The picture's obscured with a red smear. It's fresh blood. I look up in sudden fear. From the bed, a hand is pulling aside the curtain. That's when I wake up. Bravo, applauded someone. The Zet frowned momentarily, then realized that the comment was directed toward another of the chattering groups crowded into the gallery. She sipped her champagne. She must be a bit tight, or she'd never have started talking about the dreams. What do you think, Dr. Magnus? It was the gallery opening of Covent Garden. The venerable fruit, flower, and vegetable market, preserved from the demolition crew, had been renovated into an airy mall of expensive shops and galleries. London's new shopping experience, Lisette thought, an unhappy hybrid of born-again, Victorian exhibition hall and trendy shops. Let the dead past bury its dead. She wondered what they might make of the old Billingsgate fish market. Should save when its fight to preserve that landmark, as now seemed unlikely. Is this dream, then, a recurrent one, Miss Zeirig? She tried to read interest or skepticism in Dr. Magnus's pale blue eyes. They told her nothing. Recurrent enough to make me mention it to Danielle, she finished in her thoughts. Danielle Borland shared a flat. She'd stopped terming it an apartment, even in her own mind. With her in a row of terrace houses in Bloomsbury, within an easy walk of London University. The gallery was Maitland Redden's project. Danielle was another. Whether Maitland really thought to make a business of it, or only intended to showcase his many friends' not always evident talents, was not open to discussion. His gallery in Knightsbridge was certainly successful, if that meant anything. How often is that? Dr. Magnus touched his glass to his blonde-bearded lips. He was drinking only Perrier water, and at that was using his glass for little more than to gesture. I don't know. Maybe half a dozen times since I can remember. And then, that may again, since I came to London. You're a student at London University, I believe, Danielle said. That's right, in art. I'm over here on a fellowship. Danielle had modeled for an occasional session. Lisette now was certain it was solely from a desire to display her body rather than due to any financial need. And when a muttered profanity at a dropped brush disclosed a common American heritage, the two emigres had rallied at a pub afterward to exchange news and views. Lisette's bed sit near the museum was impossible, and Danielle's roommate had just skipped to the continent with 2 months owing. By closing time, it was settled. How's your glass? Danielle, finding them in the crowd, shook her head in mock dismay and refilled Lisette's glass before she could cover it with her hand. "And you, Dr. Magnus?"
"Quite well, thank you."
"Danielle, let me give you a hand?"
Maitland had charmed the two of them into acting as hostesses for his opening.
"Nonsense, darling. When you see me starting to pant with the heat, then call up the reserves. Until then, do keep Dr. Magnus from straying away to the other parties."
Danielle swirled off with her champagne bottle and her smile. "The gallery christens such things may be after Richard Burton, not Liz Taylor's ex." Danielle kept explaining and got laughs each time. "Was a jostle with friends and well-wishers, as were most of the shops tonight. Private parties with evening dress and champagne, only a scattering of displaced tourists gaping and photographing. She and Danielle were both wearing slit-to-thigh crepe de chine evening gowns and could have passed for sisters. Lisette, blonde, green-eyed, with a dust of freckles. Danielle, light brunette, hazel-eyed, acclimated to the extensive facial makeup London women favored. Both tall, without seeming cultish, and close enough of size to wear each other's clothes.
"It must be distressing to have the same nightmare over and again," Dr. Magnus prompted her.
"There have been others as well, some recurrent, some not. Similar in that I wake up feeling like I've been through the sets of some old Hammer film."
"I gather you were not actually troubled with such nightmares until recently?"
"Not recently. Being in London seems to have triggered them. I suppose it's repressed anxieties over being in a strange city. It was bad enough that she'd been taking some of Danielle's pills in order to seek dreamless sleep."
"Is this, then, your first time in London, Miss Zayrig?"
"It is," she added, to seem less a typical American student, "although my family was English."
"Your parents?"
"My mother's parents were both from London. They immigrated to the States just after World War I.
"Then this must have been rather a bit like coming home for you."
"Not really. I'm the first of our family to go overseas, and I have no memory of mother's parents. Grandmother Keswick died the morning I was born. Something mother never was able to work through emotionally," Lisette added to herself.
"And have you consulted a physician concerning these nightmares?"
"I'm afraid your National Health Service is a bit more than I can cope with."
Lisette grimaced at the memory of the night she had tried to explain to a Pakistani intern why she wanted sleeping medications. She suddenly hoped her words hadn't offended Dr. Magnus, but then he scarcely looked the type who would approve of socialized medicine. Urbane, perfectly at ease in formal evening attire, he reminded her somewhat of a blonde-bearded Peter Cushing. "Inter Christopher Lee in black cape," she mused, glancing toward the door. For that matter, she wasn't at all certain just what sort of Dr. Magnus might be. Danielle had insisted she talk with him, very likely had insisted that Maitland invite him to the private opening. The man has such insight, and he's written a number of books on dreams and the subconscious, and not just rehashes of Freudian silliness.
"Are you going to be staying in London for some time, Miss Zayrig?"
"At least until the end of the year."
"Too long a time to wait to see whether these bad dreams will go away once you're back home in San Francisco, don't you agree? It can't be very pleasant for you, and you really should look after yourself."
Lisette made no answer. She hadn't told Dr. Magnus she was from San Francisco. So then Danielle had already talked to him about her. Dr. Magnus smoothly produced his card, discreetly offered it to her.
"I should be most happy to explore this further with you on a professional level, should you so wish."
"I don't really think it's worth..."
"Of course it is, my dear. Why otherwise would we be talking? Perhaps next Tuesday afternoon?
If there's a convenient time?"
Lisette slipped his card into her handbag. "If nothing else, perhaps he could supply with some barbs or something."
"Three?"
"Three it is, then."
The passageway was poorly lighted, and Lisette felt a vague sense of dread as she hurried along it, holding the hem of her nightgown away from the gritty filth beneath her bare feet. Peeling scabs of wallpaper blotched the leprous plaster, and when she held the candle close, the gouges and scratches that patterned the walls
with insane graffiti seemed disquietingly non-random. Against the mottled plaster, her figure threw a double shadow, distorted, one crouching forward, the other following. A full-length mirror paneled one segment of the passageway, and Lizette paused to study her reflection. Her face appeared frightened, her blonde hair in disorder. She wondered at her nightgown, pale, silken, billowing, of an antique mode, not remembering how she came to be wearing it, nor could she think how it was that she had come to this place. Her reflection puzzled her. Her hair seemed longer than it should be, trailing down across her breasts. Her finely chiseled features, prominent jawline, straight nose, her face, except the expression was not hers. Lips fuller, more sensual, redder than her lip gloss glinted, teeth fine and white, her green eyes intense beneath level brows. Cat, cruel yearning. Lizette released them of her gown, raised her fingers to reflection and wonder. Her fingers passed through the glass, touched the face beyond. Not a mirror, a doorway of a crypt. The mirror image fingers that rose to her face, twisted in her hair, pulled her face forward. Glass-cold lips bruised her own. The dank breath of the tomb flowed into her mouth. Dragging herself from the embrace, Lizette felt a scream rip from her throat, and Danielle was shaking her awake. The business card read Dr. Ingmar Magnus, followed simple by consultations and a Kensington address. Not Harley Street, at any rate. Lizette considered it for the 100th time, watching for street names on the corners of buildings as she walked down Kensington Church Street from the Notting Hill Gate Station. No clue as to what type of doctor, nor what sort of consultations. Wonderfully vague and just the thing to circumvent licensing laws, no doubt. Danielle had lent her one of his books to read, The Self Reborn, put out by one of those minuscule scholarly publishers clustered about the British Museum. Lizette found it a bewildering melange of occult philosophy and lunatic fringe theory, all evidently having something to do with reincarnation, and gave it up after the first chapter. She had decided not to keep the appointment until her nightmare Sunday night had given force to Danielle's insistence. Lizette wore a loose silk blouse above French designer jeans and ankle-strap sandal-toe high heels. The early summer heat wave now threatened rain, and she would have to run for it if the gray skies made good. She turned into Holland Street, past the recently closed Equinox bookshop, where Danielle had purchased various works by Aleister Crowley, a series of back streets. She consulted her map of central London, brought her to a modestly respectable row of 19th-century brick houses, now done over into offices and flats. She checked the number on the brass plaque with her card, sucked in her breath, and entered. Lizette hadn't known what to expect. She wouldn't have been surprised, knowing some of Danielle's friends, to have been greeted with clouds of incense, Eastern music, robe initiates. Instead, she found a disappointedly mundane waiting room, rather small but expensively furnished, where a pretty Eurasian receptionist took her name and spoke into an intercom. Lizette noted that there was no one else, patients, clients, in the waiting room. She glanced at her watch and noticed she was several minutes late. "Please do come in, Miss Sayrid." Dr. Magnus stepped out of his office and ushered her inside. Lizette had seen a psychiatrist briefly a few years before at her parents' demand, and Dr. Magnus's office suggested the same, from the tasteful, relaxed decor, the shelves of scholarly books, down to the traditional psychoanalyst couch. She took a chair beside the modern, rather carefully arranged desk, and Dr. Magnus seated himself comfortably in the leather swivel chair behind it. "I almost didn't come," Lizette began, somewhat aggressively. "I'm very pleased that you did decide to come." Dr. Magnus smiled reassuringly. "It doesn't require a trained eye to see that something is troubling you. When the unconscious tries to speak to us, it is foolhardy to attempt to ignore its message." "Meaning that I may be cracking up?" "I'm sure that must concern you, my dear. However, very often dreams such as yours are evidence of the emergence of a new level of self-awareness, sort of growing pains of the psyche, if you will. and not to be considered a negative experience by any means. They distress you only because you do not understand them. Even as a child, kept in ignorance through sexual repression, is frightened by the changes of puberty. With your cooperation, I hope to help you come to understand the changes of your growing self-awareness, for it is only through a complete realization of oneself that one can achieve personal fulfillment and thereby true inner peace. I'm afraid I can't afford to undergo analysis just now. Let me begin by emphasizing to you that I am not suggesting psychoanalysis. I do not in the least consider you to be neurotic, Ms. Sayrig. What I strongly urge is an exploration of your unconsciousness, a discovery of your whole self. My task is only to guide you along the course of your self-discovery, and for this privilege, I charge no fee. I hadn't realized the National Health Service was this inclusive. Dr. Magnus laughed easily. It isn't, of course. My work is supported by a private foundation. There are many others who wish to learn certain truths of our existence, to seek answers where mundane science has not yet so much as realized there are questions. In that regard, I am simply another paid researcher, and the results of my investigations are made available to those who share with us this yearning to see beyond the stultifying boundaries of modern science. He indicated the book-lined wall behind his desk. Much of one shelf appeared to contain books with his own name prominent upon their spines. "Do you intend to write a book about me?" Lizette meant to put more of a note of protest in her voice. "It is possible that I may wish to record some of what we discovered together, my dear, but only with scrupulous discretion, and needless to say, only with your complete permission." "My dreams." Lizette remembered the book of his that she had tried to read. "Do you consider them to be evidence of some previous incarnation?" "Perhaps. We can't be certain until we explore them further. Does the idea of reincarnation smack too much of the occult to your liking, Miss Sayrig? Perhaps we should speak in more fashionable terms of Jungian archetypes, genetic memory, or mental telepathy. The fact that the phenomenon has so many designations is ample proof that dreams of a previous existence are a very real part of the unconscious mind. It is undeniable that many people have experienced, in dreams or under hypnosis, memories that cannot possibly arise from their personal experience. Whether you believe that the immortal soul leaves the physical body at death to be reborn in the living embryo, or prefer to attribute it to inherited memories engraved upon DNA, or whatever explanation, this is a very real phenomenon and has been observed throughout history. As a rule, these memories of past existence are entirely buried within the unconscious. Almost everyone has experienced déjà vu. Subjects under hypnosis have spoken in languages and archaic dialects of which their conscious mind has no knowledge, have recounted in detail memories of previous lives. In some cases, these submerged memories burst forth as dreams. In these instances, the memory is usually one of some emotionally laden experience, something too potent to remain buried. I believe that this is the case with your nightmares. The fact that they are recurrent, being evidence of some profound significance in the events they recall. Lizette wished for a cigarette. She had all but stopped buying cigarettes with British prices, and from the absence of ashtrays here, Dr. Magnus was a non-smoker. But why have these nightmares only lately become a problem? I think I can explain that easily enough. Your forebears were from London. The dreams became a problem after you arrived in London. While it is usually difficult to define any relationship between the subject and the remembered existence, the timing and the force of your dream regressions would seem to indicate that you may be the reincarnation of someone, an ancestress perhaps, who lived here in London during this past century. In that case, the nightmares should go away when I return to the States. Not necessarily. Once the doorway to the unconscious is opened, it is not so easily closed again. Moreover, you say that you had experienced these dreams on rare occasions prior to your coming here. I would suggest that what you are experiencing is a natural process. A submerged part of yourself is seeking expression, and it would be unwise to deny this shadow stranger within you. I might further argue that your presence here in London is hardly coincidence, that your decision to study here was determined by that part of you who emerges in these dreams. Lisette decided she wasn't ready to accept such implications just now. What do you propose? Dr. Magnus folded his hands as neatly as a bishop at prayer. Have you ever undergone hypnosis?
No. She wished she hadn't made that sound like two syllables.
It has proved to be extraordinarily efficacious in a great number of cases such as your own, my dear. Please do try to put from your mind the ridiculous trappings and absurd mumbo-jumbo with which the popular imagination connotes hypnotism. Hypnosis is no more than a technique through which we may release the entirety of the unconscious mind to free expression, unrestricted by the countless artificial barriers that make us strangers to ourselves. You want to hypnotize me? The British inflection came to her, turning her statement into both question and protest. With your fullest cooperation, of course. I think it best. Through regressive hypnosis, we can explore the significance of these dreams that trouble you. However, the shadow stranger within yourself. Remember, this is a part of you that cries out for conscious expression. It is only through the full realization of one's identity, of one's total self, that true inner tranquility may be achieved. Know thyself and you will find peace.
Know myself?
Precisely. You must put aside this false sense of guilt. Miss Sayrig, you are not possessed by some alien and hostile force. These dreams, these memories of another existence, this is you.
Some bloody weirdo made a pass at me this afternoon, Lisette confided. On the tube, was it?
Danielle stood on her toes, groping along the top of their bookshelf. Freshly showered, she was wearing only a lace-trimmed teddy. Cami knickers, they called them in the shops here, and her straining thigh muscles shaped her buttocks nicely. In Kensington, actually, after I had left Dr. Magnus's office, Lisette was lounging in an old satin slip she'd found at a stall in Church Street. They were drinking Bristol cream out of brandy snifters. It was an intimate sort of evening they loved to share together, when not in the company of Danielle's various friends. I was walking down Holland Street, and there was this sea-looking creep all dressed out in punk regalia, pressing his face against the door where that Equinox bookshop used to be. I made the mistake of glancing at him as I passed, and he must have seen my reflection in the glass, because he spun right around, looked straight at me, and said, "Darling, what a lovely surprise to see you." Lisette sipped her sherry. Well, I gave him my hardest stare, and would you believe the creep just stood there smiling like he knew me? And so I yelled, "Piss off," in my loudest American accent, and he just froze there with his mouth hanging open. "Here it is," Danielle announced. I'd shoved it beside Roland Franklin's We Pass From View. "That's another you ought to read. I must remember to someday return it to that cute Liverpool writer who lent it to me." She settled cozily beside Lisette on the couch, handed her a somewhat smudged paperback, and resumed her glass of sherry. The book was entitled More Stately Mansions, Evidence of the Infinite, by Dr. Ingmar Magnus, and bore an affectionate inscription from the author to Danielle. This is the first, the later printings had two of his studies deleted. I can't imagine why, but these are the sort of obsessions he is describing to you. "He wants to put me in one of his books?" Danielle told her with such an extravagant leer. "Can a woman trust a man who writes such ardent inscriptions to place on her under hypnosis?" "Dr. Magnus is a perfect gentleman," Danielle assured her, somewhat huffily. "He's a distinguished scholar and is thoroughly dedicated to his research. And besides, I've let him hypnotize me on a few occasions."
"I didn't know that. Whatever for?"
"Dr. Magnus is always seeking suitable subjects. I was fascinated by his work, and when I met him at a party, I offered to undergo hypnosis."
"What happened?"
Danielle seemed envious.
"Nothing worth writing about, I'm afraid. He said I was either too thoroughly integrated, or that my previous lives were too deeply buried. That's often the case, he says, which is why absolute proof of reincarnation is so difficult to demonstrate. After a few sessions, I decided I couldn't spare time to try further."
"But what was it like?"
"As adventurous as taking a nap.
No caped Svengali staring into my eyes, no lambent girasol ring, no swirling lights, quite dull, actually. Dr. Magnus simply lulls you to sleep. Sounds safe enough, so long as I don't get molested walking back from his office. Playfully, Danielle stroked her hair. You hardly look the punk rock type. You haven't chopped off your hair with garden shears and dyed the stubble green, and not a single safety pin through your cheek. Actually, I suppose he may not have been a punk rocker. Seemed a bit too old, and he wasn't garish enough. It's just that he was wearing a lot of black leather, and he had gold earrings and some sort of medallion. In front of the Equinox, did you say? How curious. Well, I think I gave him a good start. I glanced in a window to see whether he was trying to follow me, but he was just standing there looking stunned. Might have been an honest mistake. Remember the old fellow at Midge and Fiona's party who kept insisting he knew you? And he was pissed out of his skull, otherwise he might have been able to come up with a more original line. Lisette paged through more stately mansions, while Danielle selected a Tangerine Dream album from the stack and placed it on her stereo at low volume. The music seemed in keeping with the gray drizzle of the night outside and the coziness within their sitting room. Seeing she was busy reading, Danielle poured sherry for them both and stood studying the bookshelves, a hodgepodge of occult and metaphysical topics stuffed together with art books and recent paperbacks in no particular order, wedged between Aleister Crowley's Magic and Theory in Practice and How I Discovered My Infinite Self by an Initiate. She spotted Dr. Magnus's most recent book, The Shadow Stranger. She pulled it down, and Dr. Magnus stared thoughtfully from the back of the dust jacket. Do you believe in reincarnation? Lisette asked her. I do. Or rather, I do some of the time. Danielle stood behind the couch and bent over Lisette's shoulder to see where she was reading. Midge Vaughn assures me that in a previous incarnation, I was hanged for witchcraft. Midge should be grateful she's living in the 20th century. Oh, Midge says we were sisters in the same coven and were hanged together. That's the reason for our close affinity. I'll bet Midge says that to all the girls. Oh, I like Midge. Danielle sipped her sherry and considered the rose of spines. Did you say that man was wearing a medallion? Was it a swastika or that sort of thing? No. It was something like a star in a circle, and he wore rings on every finger. Wait! Kind of greasy black hair, slicked back from a widow's peak to straight over his collar and back, eyebrows curled up into points like they've been waxed. That's it. Oh, Mephisto. Do you know him then? Not really. I've just seen him a time or two at the Equinox and a few other places. He reminds me of some ham actor playing Mephistopheles. Midge spoke of him once when we were by there, and I gather he's not part of a particular coven. Probably hadn't heard that the Equinox had closed. Never impressed me as a masher. Very likely he actually did mistake you for someone. Well, they do say that everyone has a double. I wonder if mine is walking somewhere about London, being mistaken for me. And no doubt giving some unsuspecting classmate of yours a resounding slap on the face. What if I met her suddenly? Met your doppelganger? Remember William Wilson's? Disaster, darling, disaster. There really wasn't much to it, no production at all. Lisette felt nervous, a bit silly and perhaps a touch cheated. I want you to relax, Dr. Magnus told her. All you have to do is just relax. That's what her gynecologist always said, too. Lisette thought with a sudden tenseness. She lay on her back on Dr. Magnus's analyst couch, her head on a comfortable cushion, legs stretched primly out on the leather upholstery. She deliberately worn jeans again. Fingers clenched damply over her tummy, a white gown instead of jeans. And I'd be ready for my coffin, she mused uncomfortably. Fine. That's it. You're doing fine, Lisette. Very fine. Just relax. Yes, just relax, just like that. Fine. That's it. Relax. Dr. Magnus's voice was a quiet monotone, monotonously repeating soothing encouragements. He spoke to her, tirelessly, patiently, slowly dissolving her anxiety. You feel sleepy, Lisette, relaxed and sleepy. Your breathing is slow and relaxed, slow and relaxed. Think about your breathing now, Lizette. Think how slow and sleepy and deep each breath comes. You're breathing deeper and you're feeling sleepier. Relax and sleep. Lizette, breathe and sleep. Breathe and sleep. She was thinking about her breathing. She counted the breaths. The slow, monotonous syllable of Dr. Magnus's voice seemed to blend into her breathing like a quiet, tuneless lullaby. She was sleepy, for that matter, and it was very pleasant to relax here, listening to that dim, droning murmur while he talked on and on. How much longer until the end of the lecture? You are asleep now, Lizette. You are asleep, yet you can still hear my voice. Now you are falling deeper, deeper, deeper into a pleasant, relaxed sleep, Lizette. Deeper and deeper asleep. Can you still hear my voice? Yes. You are asleep, Lizette, in a deep, deep sleep. You will remain in this deep sleep until I shall count to three. As I count to three, you will slowly arise from your sleep until you are fully awake once again. Do you understand? Yes. But when you hear me say the word amber, you will again fall into a deep, deep sleep, Lizette, just as you are asleep now. Do you understand? Yes. Listen to me as I count, Lizette. One, two, three. Lizette opened her eyes. For a moment her expression was blank, then a sudden confusion. She looked at Dr. Magnus, seated beside her, then smiled ruefully. I was asleep. I'm afraid. Or was I? You did splendidly, Miss Sayrid, Dr. Magnus beamed reassurance. You passed into a simple hypnotic state, and as you can see now, there was no more cause for concern than in catching an afternoon nap. But I'm sure I just dropped off. Lizette glanced at her watch. Her appointment had been for 3, and it was now almost 4 o'clock. Why not just settle back and rest some more, Miss Sayrig? That's it. Relax again. All you need is to rest a bit, just a pleasant rest. Her wrist fell back onto the cushions as her eyes fell shut. Amber. Dr. Magnus studied her calm features for a moment. You are asleep now, Lizette. Can you hear me? Yes. I want you to relax, Lizette. I want you to fall deeper, deeper, deeper into sleep. Deep, deep sleep. Far, far, far into sleep. He listened to her breathing, then suggested, You are thinking of your childhood now, Lizette. You are a little girl, not even in school yet. Something is making you very happy. You remember how happy you are? Why are you so happy? Lizette made a childish giggle. It's my birthday party, and Ollie the Clown came to play with us. And how old are you today? I'm 5. Her right hand twitched, extended fingers and thumb. Go deeper now, Lizette. I want you to reach farther back, far, far back into your memories. Go back to a time before you were a child in San Francisco. Far, further back, Lizette. I want you to go back to the time of your dreams. He studied her face. She remained in a deep hypnotic trance, but her expression registered sudden anxiousness. It was as if she lay in normal sleep, reacting to some intense nightmare. She moaned. Deeper, Lizette. Don't be afraid to remember. Let your mind flow back to another time. Her features still showed distress, but she seemed less agitated as his voice urged her deeper. Where are you? I'm not certain. Her voice came in a well-bred English accent. It's quite dark. Only a few candles are burning. I'm frightened. Go back to a happy moment. Dr. Magnus urged her as her tone grew sharp with fear. You are happy now. Something very pleasant and wonderful is happening to you. Anxiety drained from her features. Her cheeks flushed. She smiled pleasurably. Where are you now? I'm dancing. It's a grand ball to celebrate Her Majesty's Diamond Jubilee. And I've never seen such a throng. I'm certain Charles means to propose to me tonight, but he's ever so shy, and now he's simply fuming that Captain Stapleton has the next 2 dances. He's so dashing in his uniform. Everyone is watching us together. What is your name?
Elizabeth Beresford.
Where do you live, Miss Beresford?
We have a house in Chelsea. Her expression abruptly changed. It's dark again. I'm all alone. I can't see myself. Although surely the candles shed sufficient light, there's something there in the candlelight. I'm moving closer.
One?
It's an open coffin, fear edged her voice.
Two?
God in heaven.
Three?
We, Danielle announced grandly, are invited to a party. She produced an engraved card from her bag, presented it to Lizette, then went to hang up her damp raincoat. Bloody English summer weather, Lizette heard her from the kitchen. Is there any more coffee made? Oh, fantastic. She reappeared with a cup of coffee and an open box of cookies. Lizette couldn't get used to calling them biscuits.
Want some?
No, thanks. Bad for my figure. And coffee on an empty tummy is bad for the nerves, Danielle said pointedly.
Who is Beth Garrington?
Lizette studied the invitation.
Danielle tried to wash down a mouthful of crumbs with too hot coffee.
Some friend of Midge's. Midge dropped by the gallery this afternoon and gave me the invitation. A costume revel. Rock stars to royalty among the guests. Midge promises that it will be super fun. Said the last party Beth threw was unbridled debauchery. There was cocaine being passed around in an antique snuff box for the guests. Can you imagine that much coke?
And how did Midge manage the invitation?
I gather discerning Miss Garrington had admired several of my drawings that Maitland has on display.
Yea,
even unto so far as to purchase one. Midge told her that she knew me and that we were two ornaments for any debauchery.
The invitation is in both our names.
Midge likes you.
Midge despises me. She's jealous as a cat.
Then she must have told our depraved hostess what a lovely couple we make.
Besides, Midge is jealous of everyone, even dear Maitland, whose interest in me very obviously is not of the flesh. But don't fret about Midge. English women are naturally bitchy towards foreign women. They're oh so proper and fashionable, but they never shave their legs. That's why I love my fellow Americans.
Danielle kissed her chastely on top of her head, powdering Lizette's hair with biscuit crumbs.
And I'm cold and wet and dying for a shower. How about you?
A masquerade? Lizette wondered. What sort of costume?
Not something that we'll have to trot off to one of those rental places for, surely.
From what Midge suggests, anything goes so long as it's wild. Just create something divinely decadent, and we're sure to knock them dead. Danielle had seen cabaret half a dozen times. It's to be in some back-alley stately old home in Maida Vale, so there's no danger that the tenants downstairs will call the cops.
When Lizette remained silent, Danielle gave her a playful nudge.
Darling, it's a party we're invited to, not a funeral.
What is it?
Didn't your session with Dr. Magnus go well?
I suppose it did.
Lizette smiled without conviction. I really can't say. All I did was doze off. Dr. Magnus seemed quite excited about it, though. I found it all, well, just a little bit scary.
I thought you said you just dropped off.
What was scary?
It's hard to put into words. It's like when you're starting to have a bad trip on acid. There's nothing wrong that you can explain, but somehow your mind is telling you to be afraid.
Danielle sat back down beside her and squeezed her arm about her shoulders.
That sounds to me like Dr. Magnus is getting somewhere. I felt just the same sort of free anxiety the first time I underwent analysis.
It's a good sign, darling. It means you're beginning to understand all those troubled secrets the ego keeps locked away.
Perhaps the ego keeps them locked away for some perfectly good reason?
Meaning hidden sexual conflicts, I suppose. Danielle's fingers gently massaged Lizette's shoulder and neck.
Oh, Lizette, you mustn't be shy about getting to know yourself.
I think it's exciting.
Lizette curled up against her, resting her cheek against Danielle's breast, while the other girl's fingers soothed the tension from her muscles.
She supposed she was overreacting. After all, the nightmares were what distressed her so. Dr. Magnus seemed completely confident that he could free her from them.
"Which of your drawings do our prospective hostess buy?"
Lizette asked, changing the subject.
"Oh, didn't I tell you?"
Danielle lifted up her chin. "It was that charcoal study I did of you."
Lizette closed the shower curtains as she stepped into the tub. It was one of those long, narrow, deep
tubs, beloved of English bathrooms, that always made her think of a coffin for two. A Rube Goldberg plumbing arrangement connected the hot and cold taps, and from the common spout was affixed a rubber hose with a shower head, which one might either hang from a hook on the wall or hold in hand. Danielle had replaced the ordinary shower head with a shower massage when she moved in, but she left the previous tenant's shaving mirror, a beveled glass oval in a heavily enameled antique frame, hanging on the wall above the hook. Lizette glanced at her face in the steamed-over mirror. "I shouldn't have let you display that at the gallery." "But why not?" Danielle was shampooing, and lather blinded her as she turned about. "Maitland thinks it's one of my best." Lizette reached around her for the shower attachment. "It seems a bit personal somehow. All those people looking at me. It's an invasion of privacy." "But it's thoroughly immodest, darling. Not like some topless billboard in Soho." The drawing was a charcoal and pencil study of Lizette, then in what Danielle described as her David Hamilton phase. And sitting for it, Lizette had piled her hair in a high chignon and dressed in an antique cotton camisole and drawers with lace insertions that she found at a shop in Westbourne Grove. Danielle called it dark rose. Lizette had thought it made her look fat. Danielle grasped blindly for the shower massage, and Lizette placed it in her hand. "It just seems a bit too personal to have some total stranger owning my picture." Shampoo coursed like sea foam over Danielle's breasts. Lizette kissed the foam. "Ah, but soon she won't be a total stranger," Danielle reminded her, her voice muffled by the pulsing shower spray. Lizette felt Danielle's nipples harden beneath her lips. The brunette still pressed her eyes tightly shut against the force of the shower, but her other hand cupped Lizette's head encouragingly. Lizette gently moved her kisses downward along the other girl's slippery belly, kneeling as she did so. Danielle murmured, and when Lizette's tongue probed her drenched curls, she shifted her legs to let her knees rest beneath the blonde girl's shoulders. The shower massage dropped from her fingers. Lizette made love to her with a passion that surprised her, spontaneous, suddenly fierce, unlike their usual tenderness together. Her lips and tongue pressed into Danielle's almost ravenously, her own ecstasy even more intense than that which she was drawing from Danielle. Danielle gasped and clung to the shower rail with one hand, her other fist clenched upon the curtain, sobbing as a long orgasm shuddered through her. "Please, darling," Danielle finally managed to beg. "My legs are too wobbly to hold me up any longer." She drew away. Lizette raised her face. "Oh?" Lizette rose to her feet with drug movements. Her wide eyes at last registered Danielle's startled expression. She touched her lips and turned to look in the bathroom mirror. "I'm sorry," Danielle put her arms about her shoulders. "I must have started my period. I didn't realize." Lizette stared at the blood-smeared face in the fog-shaving mirror. Danielle caught her as she started to slump. She was conscious of the cold rain that pelted her face, washing from her nostrils the too sweet smell of decaying flowers. Slowly she opened her eyes into darkness and mist. Rain fell steadily, spiritlessly gluing her white gown to her drenched flesh. She had been walking in her sleep again. Wakefulness seemed forever in coming to her, so that only by slow degrees did she become aware of herself, of her surroundings. For a moment she felt as if she were a chess piece arrayed upon a board in a darkened room, all about her stone monuments crowded together, their weathered surfaces streaming with moisture. She felt neither fear nor surprise that she stood in a cemetery. She pressed her bare arms together across her breasts. Water ran over pale skin as smoothly as upon the marble tombstones, and though her flesh felt as cold as the drenched marble, she did not feel chilled. She stood barefoot, her hair clinging to her shoulders, above the low-necked cotton gown that was all she wore. Automatically her steps carried her through the darkness, as if following a familiar path through the maze of glistening stone. She knew where she was. This was Highgate Cemetery. She could not recall how she knew that, since she had no memory of ever having been to this place before. No more could she think how she knew her steps were taking her deeper into the cemetery instead of toward the gate. A splash of color trickled onto her breast, staining its paleness as the rain dissolved into a red rose above her heart.
She opened her mouth to scream, and a great bubble of unswallowed blood spewed from her lips.
"Elizabeth! Elizabeth! Lizette! Lizette!"
Whose voice called her? "Lizette! You can wake up now, Lizette!"
Dr. Magnus's face peered into her own. Was there sudden concern behind that urbane mask?
"You're awake now, Miss Zayrig. Everything is all right."
Lizette stared back at him for a moment, uncertain of her reality, as if suddenly awakened from some profound nightmare.
I thought I was dead." Her eyes still held her fear.
Dr. Magnus smiled to reassure her. "Somnambulism, my dear. You remembered an episode of sleepwalking from a former life. Tell me, have you yourself ever walked in your sleep?"
Lizette pressed her hands to her face, abruptly examined her fingers.
"I don't know. I mean, I don't think so." She sat up, searched in her bag for a compact. She paused for a moment before opening the mirror.
"Dr. Magnus, I don't think I care to continue these sessions."
She stared at her reflection in fascination, not touching her makeup, and when she snapped the case shut, the frightened strain began to relax from her face. She wished she had a cigarette.
Dr. Magnus sighed and pressed his fingertips together, leaning back in his chair, watched her fidget with her clothing as she sat nervously on the edge of the couch.
"Do you really wish to terminate our exploration? We have, after all, made excellent progress during these last few sessions."
"Have we?"
"We have, indeed. You have consistently remembered instances from the life of one, Elizabeth Beresford, a young English lady living in London at the close of the last century. To the best of your knowledge of your family history, she is not an ancestress."
Dr. Magnus leaned forward, seeking to impart his enthusiasm.
"Don't you see how important this is? If Elizabeth Beresford was not your ancestress, then there can be no question of genetic memory being involved. The only explanation must therefore be reincarnation, proof of the immortality of the soul. To establish this, I must first confirm the existence of Elizabeth Beresford, and from that to demonstrate that no familial bond exists between the two of you. We simply must explore this further."
"Must we? I meant, what progress have we made toward helping me, Dr. Magnus? It's all very good for you to be able to confirm your theories of reincarnation, but that doesn't do anything for me. If anything, the nightmares have grown more disturbing since we began these sessions."
"Then perhaps we dare not stop."
"What do you mean?"
Lizette wondered what he might do if she suddenly bolted from the room.
"I mean that the nightmares will grow worse regardless of whether you decide to terminate our sessions. Your unconscious self is struggling to tell you some significant message from a previous existence. It will continue to do so no matter how stubbornly you will yourself not to listen. My task is to help you listen to this voice, to understand the message it must impart to you. And with this understanding and self-awareness, you will experience inner peace. Without my help, well, to be perfectly frank, Miss Zayrig, you are in some danger of a complete emotional breakdown."
Lizette slumped back against the couch. She felt on the edge of panic and wished Danielle were there to support her.
"Why are my memories always nightmares?" Her voice shook, and she spoke slowly to control it.
"But there aren't always frightening memories, my dear. It's just that the memory of some extremely traumatic experience often seeks to come to the fore. You would expect some tremendously emotional-laden memory to be a potent one."
"Is Elizabeth Beresford dead?"
"Assuming that she was approximately 20 years of age at the time of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, she would have been past 100 today.
Besides, Miss Zayrig, her soul has been born again as your own. It must therefore follow."
"Dr. Magnus, I don't want to know how Elizabeth Beresford died."
"Of course," Dr. Magnus told her gently. "Isn't that quite obvious?"
"For a wonder, it's forgot to rain tonight."
"Thank God for small favors," Lizette commented, thinking July in London had far more to do with monsoons and the romantic city of fogs celebrated in song. "All we need is to get these rained on." She and Danielle bounced about on the back seat of the black Austin taxi, as her driver democratically seemed as willing to challenge lorries as pedestrians for the right-of-way on Edgware Road. Feeling a bit self-conscious, Lizette tugged at the hem of her patent leather trench coat. They had decided to wear brightly embroidered Chinese silk lounging pajamas that they'd found at one of the vintage clothing shops off the Portobello Road. Gauzy enough for stairs, but only a demure trouser leg showed beneath their coats. "We're going to a masquerade party," Lisette had felt obliged to explain to the driver. Her concern was needless, as he hadn't given them a second glance. Either he was used to the current Chinese look and fashion, or else a few seasons of picking up couples at discos and punk rock clubs had inured him to any sort of costume. The taxi turned into a series of side streets off Maida Vale, and eventually made a neat U-turn that seemed almost an automotive pirouette. The frenetic beat of new wave rock group clattered past the gate of an enclosed courtyard. Something Muse. The iron plaque on the brick wall was too rusted to decipher in the dark, but from the lights and noise, it must be the right address. A number of expensive-looking cars, Lisette recognized a Rolls or two and at least one Ferrari, were among those crowded against the curb. They squeezed their way past them and made for the source of the revelry, a brick-fronted townhouse of three or more stories set at the back of the courtyard. The door was opened by a girl in an abbreviated maid's costume. She checked her invitation, while a similarly clad girl took their coats, and a third invited them to select from an assortment of masks and indicated where they might change. Lisette and Danielle chose sequin domino masks that matched the dangling scarves they wore tied low across their brows. Danielle withdrew an ebony cigarette holder from her bag and considered the reflections with approval. "Divinely decadent," she drawled, gesturing with her black lacquered nails. "All that time for my eyes, and just to cover them with a mask. Perhaps later, when it's cockscrow and all unmasked." "Forward, darling," Lisette kept at her side, feeling a bit lost and out of place. When they passed before a light, it was evident that they wore nothing beneath the silk pajamas, and Lisette was grateful for the strategic brocade. As it came upon others of the newly arriving guests, she decided there was no danger of outraging anyone's modesty here, as Midge had promised anything goes so long as it's wild. And while their costumes might pass for streetwear, many of the guests need avail themselves of the changing room upstairs. A muscular young man, clad only in a leather loincloth and a sword belt, with broadsword descended the stairs, leading a buxom girl by a chain affixed to her wrist. Aside from her manacles, she wore a few scraps of leather. A couple in punk rock gear spat at them in passing. The girl was wearing a set of pasties with dangling razor blades for tassels, and a pair of black latex tights that might have been spray paint. Two girls in vintage Christian Dior new look evening gowns ogled the semi-nude swordsman from the landing above. Lisette noted the pronounced shoulders and Adam's apple and felt a twinge of jealousy that hormones and surgery could let them show a better cleavage than she could. A new wave group called The Needle was performing in a large first-floor room. Lisette supposed it was an actual ballroom, although the house's original tenants would have considered tonight's ball a danse macabre. Despite the fact that she decided the level was well past the threshold of pain, most of the guests were congregated here, with smaller, quieter parties gravitating into other rooms. Here, about half were dancing, the rest standing about trying to talk. Marijuana smoke was barely discernible within the harsh haze of British cigarettes. "There's Midge and Fiona," Danielle shouted in Lisette's ear. She waved energetically and steered a course through the dancers. Midge was wearing an elaborate medieval gown, a heavily brocaded affair that ran from the floor to midway across her nipples. Her blonde hair was piled high in some sort of conical headpiece, complete with flowing scarf. Fiona waited upon her in a pageboy's costume. "Are you just getting here?" Midge asked, running a disdainful glance down Lisette's costume. "There's champagne over on the sideboard. Wait, I'll summon one of the cute little French maids." Lisette caught two glasses from a passing tray and presented one to Danielle. It was impossible to converse, but then she hadn't anything to talk about with Midge, and Fiona was no more than a shadow. "Where's our hostess?" Danielle asked. "Not down yet," Midge managed to shout. "Beth always waits to make a grand entrance at her little dues. You won't miss her." "Speaking of entrances," Lisette commented, nodding towards a couple who were just coming onto the dance floor. The woman wore a Nazi SS officer's hat, jack boots, black trousers, and braces across her bare chest. She was astride the back of her male companion, who wore a saddle and bridle in addition to a few other bits of leather harness. I can't decide whether that's kinky or just tacky, Lizette said. Not like your little sorority tease back home, is it? Midge smiled.
Is there any coke about? Danielle interposed quickly.
There was a short while ago. Try the library. That's the room just down from where everyone's changing.
Lizette downed her champagne and grabbed a refill before following Danielle upstairs. A man in fishnet tights, motorcycle boots, and a vest comprised mostly of chain and bits of Nazi medals caught at her arm and seemed to want to dance. Instead of a mask, he wore about a pound of eyeshadow and black lipstick. She shouted an inaudible excuse, held a finger to her nostrils, and sniffed and darted after Danielle.
That was Eddie Teeth, lead singer for the Trepans, whom you just cut, Danielle told her. Why didn't he grab me?
You'll get your chance, Lizette told her. I think he's following us.
Danielle dragged her to a halt halfway up the stairs.
Got to right here, loves. Eddie Teeth flipped a silver spoon and fial that dangled amidst the chains on his vest.
Couldn't take the noise in there any longer, Lizette explained.
Needles shit, Eddie Teeth wrapped an arm about either waist and propelled them up the stairs.
You gaseous sisters?
I can dig incest.
The library was pleasantly crowded. Lizette decided she didn't want to be cornered with Eddie Teeth. A dozen or more guests stood about sniffing and conversing energetically. Seated at a table, two of the ubiquitous maids busily cut lines into mirrors and set them out for the guests, whose number remained more or less constant as people wandered in and left. A cigarette box offered tightly rolled joints.
That's Ty. Eddie Teeth groped for a handful of the joints, stuck one in each girl's mouth, the rest inside his vest.
Danielle giggled and fitted hers to her cigarette holder. Unfastening a silver tube from his vest, he snorted two thick lines from one of the mirrors.
Toot your eyeballs out, loves, he invited them.
One of the maids collected the mirrors when they had finished and replaced it with another. A dozen lines of cocaine neatly arranged across its surface. Industrially, she began to work a chunk of rock through a sifter to replenish the empty mirror. Lizette watched in fascination. This finally brought home to her the wealth this party represented. All the rest simply seemed to her like something out of a movie, but dealing out coke to more than 100 guests was an extravagance she could relate to.
Danielle Borland, isn't it?
A man dressed as Mephistopheles bowed before them.
Adrian Treganet, we've met at one of Midge Vaughn's parties, you may recall.
Danielle stared at the face below the domino mask.
Oh, yes. Lizette, it's Mephisto himself.
Then this is Miss Sayrig, the subject of your charcoal drawing that Beth so admires.
Mephisto caught Lizette's hand and bent his lips to it.
Beth is so much looking forward to meeting you both.
Lizette retrieved her hand.
Aren't you the rude fellow who accosted you in Kensington some days ago?
Treganet finished apologetically. Yes, I'm afraid so. But you really must forgive me for my forwardness. I actually did mistake you for a very dear friend of mine, you see. Won't you let me make amends over a glass of champagne?
Certainly, Lizette decided that she had had quite enough of Eddie Teeth, and Danielle was quite capable of fending for herself if she grew tired of having her breast squeezed by a famous pop star.
Treganet quickly returned with two glasses of champagne. Lizette finished another two lines and smiled appreciatively as she accepted a glass.
Danielle was trying to shotgun Eddie Teeth through her cigarette holder, and Lizette thought it a good chance to slip away.
Your roommate is tremendously talented, Treganet suggested. Of course, she chose so charming a subject for her drawing.
Slick as snake oil, Lizette thought, letting him take her arm.
How very nice of you to say so. However, I really feel a bit embarrassed to think that some stranger owns a portrait of me in my underwear.
Utterly chaste, my dear, as chaste as the dark rose of its title. Beth chose to hang it in her boudoir, so I hardly think it's on public display. I suspect from your garments in the drawing that you must share Beth's appreciation for the dress and manners of this past century.
Which is something I never suspect of our hostess, judging from this party, Lizette considered.
I'm quite looking forward to meeting her. I assume that Miss is a bit too modern for one of such quiet taste.
Is it Miss or Mrs. Garrington?
Ah, I hadn't meant to suggest an impression of a genteel dowager. Beth is entirely of your generation. A few years older than yourself, perhaps, although I find Miss too suggestive of American slang. I'm sure Beth would not object. However, there's no occasion for such formality here.
You seem to know her well, Mr. Tregannett.
It is an old family. I know her aunt, Julia Weatherford, quite well, through our mutual interest in the occult.
Perhaps you, too?
Not really. Danielle is the one you should chat with about that. My field is art. I'm over here on fellowship at London University. She watched Danielle and Eddie Teeth toddle off for the ballroom and jealously decided that Danielle's taste and her acquaintance left much to be desired.
Could I have some more champagne?
To be sure. I won't be a moment. Lisette snorted a few more lines while she waited. A young man dressed as an Edwardian dandy offered his snuff box and gravely demonstrated its use. Lisette was struggling with a sneezing fit when Tregannett returned.
You needn't have gone to all that bother, she told him. These little French maids are dashing about with trays of champagne.
But those glasses have lost a proper chill, Tregannett explained, to your very good health.
Cheers, Lisette felt lightheaded and promised herself to go easy for a while. Does Beth live here with her aunt, then?
Her aunt lives on the continent. I don't believe she's visited London for several years. Beth moved in about 10 years ago. Theirs is not a large family, but they are not without wealth, as you can observe. They travel a great deal as well, and it's fortunate that Beth happened to be in London during your stay here.
Incidentally, just how long will you be staying in London?
About a year is all. Lisette finished her champagne. Then it's back to my dear, dull family in San Francisco.
Then there's no one here in London?
Decidedly not, Mr. Tregannett. And now, if you'll excuse me, I think I'll find the ladies.
Cocaine might well be the champagne of drugs, but cocaine and champagne didn't seem to mix well.
Lisette mused, turning the bathroom over to the next frantic guest. Her head felt really buzzy, and she thought she might do better if she found a bedroom somewhere and laid down for a moment. But then she'd most likely wake up and find some man on top of her, judging from this lot. She decided she'd lay off the champagne and have just a line or two to shake off the feeling of having been sandbagged. The crowd in the study had changed during her absence. Just now it was dominated by a group of guests dressed in costumes from the Rocky Horror Show, now closing out its long run at the Comedy Theater in Piccadilly. Lisette had grown bored with the fad the film version had generated in the States and pushed her way past the group as they vigorously danced the time warp and bellowed out songs from the show.
Give yourself over to absolute pleasure, someone sang in her ear as she industriously snorted a line from the mirror.
Erotic nightmares beyond any measure, the song continued.
Lisette finished a second line and decided she had had enough. She straightened from the table and broke for the doorway.
The tall transvestite, dressed as Frankie, barred her with a dramatic gesture, singing ardently,
"Don't dream it, be it."
Lisette blew him a kiss and ducked around him. She wished she could find Danielle first, if she could handle the ballroom that long. The dance floor was far more crowded than when they'd come in. At least all these jostling bodies seemed to absorb some of the decibels from the blaring banks of amplifiers and speakers. Lisette looked in vain for Danielle amidst the dancers, succeeding only in getting champagne sloshed on her back. She caught sight of Midge, recognizable above the mob by her conical medieval headdress, and pushed her way toward her. Midge was being fed caviar and bits of toast by Fiona, while she talked with an older woman who looked like the pictures Lisette had seen of Marlene Dietrich dressed in men's formal evening wear.
"Have you seen Danielle?" Lisette asked her.
"Why, not recently, darling," Midge smiled, licking caviar from her lips with the tip of her tongue.
"I believe she and the rock singer were headed upstairs for a bit more privacy. I'm sure she'll come collect you once they're finished."
"Midge, you're a cunt," Elizabeth told her through her sweetest smile. She turned away and made for the doorway, trying not to ruin her exit by staggering.
Screw Danielle. She needed to have some fresh air.
A crowd had gathered at the foot of the stairway, and she had to push through the doorway to escape the ballroom. Behind her, the needle mercifully took a break.
"She's coming down, Lisette," heard someone whisper breathlessly.
The inchoate babble of the party fell to a sudden lull that made Lisette shiver. At the top of the stairway stood a tall woman, enveloped in a black velvet cloak from her throat to her ankles. Her blonde hair was piled high in a complex variation of the once fashionable French twist. Strings of garnets entwined in her hair and edged the close-fitting black mask that covered the upper half of her face.
For a hushed interval, she stood there, gazing imperiously down upon her guests. Adrian Tregannett leapt to the foot of the stairway. He signed to a pair of maids who stepped forward to either side of their mistress. "Milords and miladies," he announced with a sweeping bow, "let us pay honor to our bewitching mistress, whose feast we celebrate tonight. I give you the Lamia who haunted Adam's dreams, Lilith." The maids smoothly swept the cloak from their mistress's shoulders. From the multitude at her feet came an audible intake of breath. Beth Garrington was attired in a strapless corselet of gleaming black leather, laced tightly about her waist. The rest of her costume consisted only of knee-length stiletto-heeled tight boots above the elbow gloves and a spiked collar around her throat, all of black leather that contrasted starkly against her white skin and blonde hair. At first, as Seth thought, she wore bullwhip coiled about her body as well, but then the coils moved, and she realized that it was an enormous black snake. "Lilith!" came the shout, chanted in a tone of awe. "Lilith!" Acknowledging their worship with a sinuous gesture, Beth Garrington descended the staircase, the serpent coiled from her gloved arm and then to the other one, entwining her clenched waist. Its eyes considered the revelers imperturbed. Champagne glasses lifted in a toast to Lilith, and the chattering voice of the party once more began to fill the house. Tregannett touched Beth's elbow as she greeted her guest at the foot of the stairway. He whispered into her ear, and she smiled graciously and moved away with him. Lisette clung to the staircase newel, watching them approach. Her head was spinning, and she desperately needed to lie down in some fresh air, but she couldn't trust her legs to carry her outside. She stared into the eyes of the serpent, hypnotized by its flickering tongue. The room seemed to surge in and out of focus. The masks of the guests seemed to leer and gloat with the awareness of some secret jest. The dancers in their fantastic costumes became a grotesque horde of satyrs and wanton demons, writhing about the ballroom in some witch's sabbat of obscene mass copulation. As in a nightmare, Lisette willed her legs to turn and run, realized that her body was no longer obedient to her will. "Beth, here's someone you've been dying to meet," Lisette heard Tregannett say. "Beth Garrington, allow me to present Lisette Sayrig." The lips beneath the black mask curved in a pleasurable smile. Lisette gazed into the eyes behind the mask and discovered that she could no longer feel her body. She thought she heard Danielle cry out her name. The eyes remained in her vision long after she slid down the newel and collapsed upon the floor. The Catherine Wheel was a pub on Kensington Church Street. They served good pub lunches there, and Lisette liked to stop in before walking down Holland Street for her sessions with Dr. Magnus. Since today was her final such session, it seemed appropriate that they should end the evening here. "While I dislike repeating myself," Dr. Magnus spoke earnestly, "I really do think we should continue." Lisette drew on a cigarette and shook her head decisively. "No way, Dr. Magnus. My nerves are shot to hell. I mean, look, when I freak out at a costume party and have to be carted home to bed by my roommate, it was like when I was a kid and got hold of some bad acid. The whole world was some bizarre and sinister freak show for weeks. Once I got my head back on, I said, no more acid." "That was rather a notorious circle you were traveling in. Further, you were, if I understand you correctly, overindulging a bit that evening. A few glasses of champagne and a little toot never did anything before but make me a bit giggly and talkative." Lisette sipped her half of lager. She'd never developed a taste for English bitter, and at least the lager was chilled. They sat across from each other at a table the size of a hubcap, she in the corner of a padded bench against the wall. He had a chair set out into the room pressed in by a wall of standing bodies. A foot away from her, on the padded bench, three young men huddled about a similar table, talking animatedly. For all that, she and Dr. Magnus might have been all alone in the room. Lisette wondered if the psychologist who had joined the faddish concept of space had been inspired in a crowded English pub. "It isn't just that I fainted at the party. It isn't just the nightmares," she paused to find words. "It's just that everything somehow seems to be drifting out of focus, out of control. It's, well, it's frightening." "Precisely why we must continue." "Precisely why we must not," Lisette sighed. They'd covered this ground already. It had been a moment of weakness when she agreed to allow Dr. Magnus to buy her a drink afterward instead of heading back to the flat. Still, he had been so distressed when she told him she was terminating their sessions.
"I've tried to cooperate with you as best I could, and I'm certain you are entirely sincere in your desire to help me."
Well, she wasn't all that certain, but no point in going into that. "However, the fact remains that since we began the sessions, my nerves have gone to hell. You say they'd be worse without the sessions. I say the sessions have made them worse. And maybe there's no connection at all. It's just that my nerves have gotten worse. So now I'm going to trust my intuition and try life without these sessions. Fair enough?"
Dr. Magnus gazed uncomfortably at his barely tasted glass of sherry.
"While I fully understand your rationale, I must in all conscience beg you to reconsider. Lizette, you are running risk that... Look, if the nightmares go away, then terrific. If they don't, I can always pack up and head back to San Francisco. That way I'll be clear of whatever it is about London that disagrees with me. And if not, I'll see my psychiatrist back home."
"Very well, then." Dr. Magnus squeezed her hand. "However, please bear in mind that I remain eager to continue our session at any time, should you change your mind."
"That's fair enough, too, and very kind of you."
Dr. Magnus lifted his glass of sherry to the light. Pensively, he remarked, "Amber."
"Lizette?" Danielle locked the front door behind her and hung up her inadequate umbrella in the hallway. She considered her face in the mirror and grimaced at the mess of her hair. "Lizette, are you here?"
No answer, and arranged things were not in the hallway. Either she was having a late session with Dr. Magnus, or else she'd wisely decided to duck undercover until this bloody rain let up. After she had to carry Lizette home in a taxi when she passed out at the party, Danielle was starting to feel real concerned over her state of health. Danielle kicked off her damp shoes as she entered the living room. The curtains were drawn against the grayness outside, and she switched on a lamp to brighten the flat a bit. Her dress clung to her like a clammy fish skin. She shivered and thought about a cup of coffee. If Lizette hadn't returned yet, there wouldn't be any brood. She'd have a warm shower instead, and after that she'd see to the coffee. If Lizette hadn't returned to set a pot going in the meantime. "Lizette?" The bedroom was empty. Danielle turned on the overhead light. Christ, it was gloomy. So much for long English summer evenings. With all the rain, she couldn't remember when she'd last seen the sun. She struggled out of her damp dress, spread it flat across her bed with the vague hope that might not wrinkle too badly, then tossed her bra and tights onto a chair. Slipping into her bathrobe, Danielle padded back into the living room. Still no sign of Lizette, and it was past 9. Perhaps she'd stopped off at a pub. Crossing to the stereo, Danielle placed the new Blondie album on the turntable and turned up the volume. Let the neighbors complain. At least this would help dispel the evening's gloom. She cursed the delay needed to adjust the shower temperature to satisfaction, then climbed into the tub. The hot spray felt good, and she stood under it contentedly for several minutes, initially revitalized, then lulled into a delicious sense of relaxation. Through the rush of the spray, she could hear the muffled beat of the stereo. As she reached for the shampoo, she began to move her body with the rhythm. The shower curtain billowed as the bathroom door opened. Danielle risked a soapy squint around the curtain. She knew the flat was securely locked, but after seeing Psycho, it was only Lizette already undressed, her long blonde hair falling over her breasts.
"Didn't hear you come in with the stereo going," Danielle greeted her. "Come on in before you catch cold."
Danielle resumed lathering her hair as the shower curtain parted and the other girl stepped into the tub behind her. Her eyes squeezed shut against the soap. She felt Lizette's breast thrust against her back, her flat belly pressed against her buttocks. Lizette's hands came across to cup her breast gently. At least Lizette had gotten over a silly tiff about Eddie Teeth. She'd explained to Lizette that she'd ditched that greasy slob when he tried to dry hump her on the dance floor. But how do you reason with a silly thing who faints at the sight of a snake?
"Jesus, you're chilled to the bone," Danielle complained with a shiver. "Better stand under the shower and get warm. Did you get caught in the rain?"
The other girl's fingers continued to caress her breast, and instead of answering, her lips teased the nape of Danielle's neck. Danielle made a delighted sound deep in her throat, letting the spray rinse the lather from her hair and over their embraced bodies. Languidly she turned about to face her lover, closing her arms about Lizette's shoulders for support. Lisette's kisses held each taut nipple for a moment, teasing them almost painfully. Danielle pressed the other girl's face to her breast, sad as her kisses nibbled upward to her throat. She felt weak with arousal, and only Lisette's strength held her upright in the tub. Her lover's lips upon her throat tormented her beyond enduring. Danielle gasped and lifted Lisette's face to meet her own. Her mouth was open to receive Lisette's red-lipped kiss, and it opened wider as Danielle stared into the eyes of her lover. Her first emotion was one of wonder. "You're not Lisette." It was nearly midnight when Lisette unlocked the door to their flat and quietly let herself in. Only a few lights were on, and there was no sign of Danielle. Either she had gone out, or more likely had gone to bed. Lisette hung up her raincoat and wearily pulled off her shoes. She had barely caught the last train. She must have been crazy to let Dr. Magnus talk her into returning to his office for another session that late. But then he was quite right. As serious as her problems were, she really did need all the help she could give her. She felt a warm sense of gratitude to Dr. Magnus for being there when she so needed his help. The turntable had stopped, but a light on the amplifier indicated that the power was still on. Lisette cut it off and closed the lid over the turntable. She felt too tired to listen to an album just now. She became aware that the shower was running. In that case, Danielle hadn't gone to bed. She supposed she really ought to apologize to her for letting Midge's bitchy lies get under her skin. After all, she had ruined the party for Danielle. Poor Danielle had had to get her to bed and had to leave the party without ever getting to meet Beth Garrington, and she was the one Beth had invited in the first place. "Danielle, I'm back," Lisette called through the bathroom door. "Do you want anything?" No answer. Lisette looked into their bedroom just in case Danielle had invited a friend over. No, the beds were still made up. Danielle's clothes were spread out by themselves. "Danielle?" Lisette raised her voice. Perhaps she couldn't hear over the noise of the shower. "Danielle?" Surely she was all right. Lisette's feet felt damp. She looked down. A puddle of water was seeping beneath the door. Danielle must not have the shower curtain closed properly. "Danielle, you're flooding us!" Lisette opened the door and peered cautiously within. The curtain was closed right enough. A thin spray still reached through a gap, and the shower had been running long enough for the puddle to spread. It occurred to Lisette that she should see Danielle's silhouette against the translucent shower curtain. "Danielle!" She began to grow alarmed. "Danielle, are you all right?" She pattered across the wet tiles and drew aside the curtain. Danielle lay in the bottom of the tub, the spray falling on her upward smile, her flesh paler than the porcelain of the tub. It was early afternoon when they finally allowed her to return to the flat. Had she been able to think of another place to go, she probably would have gone there. Instead, Lisette wearily slumped onto the couch, too spent to pour herself the drink she desperately wanted. Somehow, she had managed to phone the police, through her hysteria, make them understand where she was. Once the squad car arrived, she had no further need to act out of her own initiative. She simply was carried along in the rush of police investigation. It wasn't until they were questioning her at New Scotland Yard that she realized she herself was not entirely free from suspicion. The victim had bled to death, the medical examiner ruled. Her blood washed down the tub drain. A safety razor used for shaving legs had been opened, its blade removed. There were razor incisions along both wrists directed lengthwise into the radial artery as opposed to the shallow crosswise cuts utilized by suicides unfamiliar with human anatomy. There was an additional incision on the left side of the throat. It was either very determined suicide or skillfully concealed murder. In view of the absence of any signs of forced entry or of a struggle, more likely the former. The victim's roommate did admit to a recent quarrel. Laboratory tests would indicate whether the victim might have been drugged or rendered unconscious through a blow. After that, the inquest would decide. Lisette had explained that she had spent the evening with Dr. Magnus. The fact that she was receiving emotional therapy, as they interpreted it, caused several mental notes to be made. Efforts to reach Dr. Magnus by telephone proved unsuccessful, but a secretary did confirm that Miss Sabrig had shown up for her appointment the previous afternoon. Dr. Magnus would get in touch with them as soon as he returned to his office. No, she did not know why he had canceled today's appointments, but it was not unusual for Dr. Magnus to dash off suddenly when essential research demanded immediate attention. After a while, they let Lisette make phone calls. She phoned her parents, then wished she hadn't. It was still the night before in California, and it was like turning back the hands of time to no avail. They urged her to take the next flight home, but of course it wasn't all that simple, and it just wasn't feasible for either of them to fly over in a second notice, since, after all, there really was nothing they could do. She phoned Maitland Redken, who was stunned at the news and offered to help in any way he could, but Lisette couldn't think of any way. She phoned Midge Vaughn, who hung up on her. She phoned Dr. Magnus, who still couldn't be reached. Mercifully, the police took care of phoning Danielle's next of kin. A physician at New Scotland Yard had spoken with her briefly and had given her some pills, a sedative to ease her into sleep after her ordeal. Jared drew her back to the flat after impressing upon her the need to be present at the inquest. She must not be concerned should any hypothetical assailant yet be lurking about, inasmuch as the flat would be under surveillance. Lisette stared dully about the flat, still unable to comprehend what had happened. The police had been thorough, measuring, dusting for fingerprints, leaving things in a mess. Bleakly, Lisette tried to convince herself that this was only another nightmare, that in a moment Danielle would pop in and find her asleep on the couch. Christ, what was she going to do with all of Danielle's things? Danielle's mother was remarried and living in Colorado. Her father was an executive in a New York investment corporation. Evidently, he had made arrangements to have the body shipped back to the States. Oh, Danielle. Lisette was too stunned for tears. Perhaps she should check into a hotel for now. No, she couldn't bear being all alone with her thoughts in a strange place. How strange she realized now that she really had no close friends in London other than Danielle, and what friends she did have were mostly people she'd met through Danielle. She left word with Dr. Magnus's secretary for him to call her once he came back in. Perhaps she should call there once again, just in case Dr. Magnus had missed her message. Lisette couldn't think what good Dr. Magnus could do, but he was such an understanding person, and she felt much better whenever she spoke with him. She considered the bottle of pills in her bag. Perhaps it would be best to take a couple of them and sleep around the clock. She felt too drained just now to have energy enough to think. The phone began to ring. Lisette stared at it for a moment without comprehension, then lunged up from the couch to answer it. "Is this Lisette Syrick?" It was a woman's voice, one Lisette didn't recognize. "Yes, who's calling, please?" "This is Beth Garrington, Lisette. I hope I'm not disturbing you." "That's quite all right. You poor dear, Maitland Redden phoned to tell me of the tragedy. I can't tell you how shocked I am. Danielle seemed such a dear from our brief contact, and she had such a great talent." "Thank you. I'm sorry you weren't able to know her better," Lisette sensed guilt and embarrassment at the memory of that brief contact. "Darling, you can't be thinking about staying in that flat alone. Is there someone there with you?" "No, there isn't. That's all right. I'll be fine." "Don't be silly. Listen, I have enough empty bedrooms in this old barn to open a hotel. Why don't you just pack a few things and come straight over?" "That's very kind of you, but I really couldn't." "Nonsense. It's no good for you to be there all by yourself. Strange as this may sound, but when I'm not throwing one of these invitational riots, this is a quiet little backwater, and things are dull as church. I'd love the company, and it will do you a world of good to get away." "You're really very kind to invite me, but I..." "Please, Lisette, be reasonable. I have guest rooms here, already made up, and I'll send the car around to pick you up. All you need to do is say yes, and toss a few things into your bag. After a good night's sleep, you'll feel much better, more like coping with things tomorrow." When Lisette didn't immediately reply, Beth added carefully, "Besides, Lisette, I understand the police haven't ruled out the possibility of murder. In that event, unless poor Danielle simply forgot to lock up, there is a chance that whoever did this has a key to your flat." "The police said they'd watch the house." "He might also be someone you both know and trust. Someone Danielle invited in?" Lisette stared wildly at the sinister shadows that lengthened about the flat. Her refuge had been violated. Even familiar objects seemed tainted and alien. She fought back tears. I don't know what to think. She realized she'd been clutching the receiver for a long, silent interval.
Poor dear. There's nothing you need think about. Now, listen. I'm at my solicitor's tidying up some property matters for Aunt Julia. I'll phone right now to have my car sent round for you. It'll be there by the time you pack your toothbrush and pajamas and whisk you straight off to bucolic Maida Vale. The maids will plump up your pillows for you, and you can have a nice nap before I get home for dinner.
Poor darling, I'll bet you haven't eaten a thing. Now say you'll come.
Thank you. It's awfully good of you.
Of course I will.
Then it's done. Don't worry about a thing, Lizette. I'll see you this evening.
Dr. Magnus hunched forward on the narrow seat of the taxi, wearily massaging his forehead and temples. It might not help his mental fatigue, but maybe the reduced muscle tension would ease his headache. He glanced at his watch, getting on past 10. He'd had no sleep last night, and it didn't look as if he'd be getting much tonight. If only those girls would answer their phone! It didn't help matters that his conscience plagued him. He had broken a sacred trust. He should never have made use of post-hypnotic suggestion last night to persuade Lizette to return for a further session. It went against all principles. But there had been no other course. The girl was adamant, and he had to know. He had been so close to establishing final proof, if only for one final session of regressive hypnosis. Afterward, he had spent a sleepless night, too excited for rest, at work in his study trying to reconcile the conflicting elements of Lizette's released memories with the historical data his research had so far compiled. By morning, he had been able to pull together just enough facts to deepen the mystery. He had phoned his secretary at home to cancel all his appointments and had spent the day at the tedious labor of delving through dusty municipal records and newspaper files, working feverishly as the past reluctantly yielded one bewildering clue after another. By now, Dr. Magnus was exhausted, hungry, and none too clean, but he had managed to establish proof of his theories. He was not elated. In doing so, he had uncovered another secret, something undreamt of in his philosophies. He began to hope that his life work was in error.
"Here's the address, sir."
"Thank you, driver." Dr. Magnus awoke from his grim reverie and saw that he had reached his destination. Quickly, he paid the driver and hurried up the walk to Lizette's flat. Only a few lights were on, and he rang the bell urgently, a helpless sense of foreboding making his movements clumsy.
"Just one moment, sir." Dr. Magnus jerked about at the voice. Two men in plain clothes approached him briskly from the pavement.
"Stand easy. We're police."
"Is something the matter, officers?" Obviously something was.
"Might we ask what your business here is, sir?"
"Certainly. I'm a friend of Miss Borlin and Miss Sayrig. I haven't been able to reach them by phone, and as I have some rather urgent matters to discuss with Miss Sayrig, I thought perhaps I might try to reach her here at her flat." He realized he was far too nervous.
"Might we see some identification, sir?"
"Is there anything wrong, officers?" Magnus repeated, producing his wallet.
"Dr. Ingmar Magnus," the tall of the pair regarded him quizzically.
"I take it you don't keep up with the news, Dr. Magnus?"
"Just what is this about?"
"I'm Inspector Bradley, Dr. Magnus, and this is Detective Sergeant Wharton, CID. We've been wanting to ask you a few questions, sir, if you'll come with us."
It was totally dark when Lizette awoke from troubled sleep. She stared wide-eyed into the darkness for a moment, wondering where she was. Slowly, memory supplanted the vague images of her dream. Switching on a lamp beside her bed, Lizette frowned at her watch. It was close to midnight. She had overslept. Beth's rolls had come for her almost before she had had time hastily to pack her overnight bag. Once at the house in Maida Vale, a maid wearing a more conventional uniform than those at her last visit had shown her to a spacious guest room on the top floor. Lizette had taken a sedative pill and gratefully collapsed onto the bed. She'd planned to catch a short nap, then meet her hostess for dinner. Instead, she had slept for almost 10 solid hours. Beth must be convinced she was a hopeless twit after this. As so often happens after an overextended nap, Lizette now felt restless. She wished she'd thought to bring a book. The house was completely silent. Surely it was too late to ring for a maid. No doubt Beth had meant to let her sleep through until morning, by now would have retired herself. Perhaps she should take another pill and go back to sleep herself. On the other hand, Beth Carrington hardly seemed the type to make it an early night. She might well still be awake, perhaps watching television where the noise wouldn't disturb her guest. In any event, Lisette didn't want to go back to sleep just yet. She climbed out of bed, realizing that she had only half undressed before falling asleep. Pulling off bra and panties, Lisette slipped into the antique nightdress of ribbons and lace she had brought along. She hadn't thought to pack slippers or a robe, but it was a warm night, and the white cotton gown was modest enough for a peek into the hall. There was a ribbon of light edging the door of the room at the far end of the hall. The rest of the hallway lay in darkness. Lisette stepped quietly from her room. Since Beth hadn't mentioned other guests and the servants' quarters were elsewhere, presumably the light was coming from her hostess's bedroom and indicated she might still be awake. Lisette decided she really should make the effort to meet her hostess while in a conscious state. She heard a faint sound of music as she tiptoed down the hallway. The door to the room was ajar, and the music came from within. She was in luck. Beth must still be up. At the doorway, she knocked softly. "Beth, are you awake? It's Lisette." There was no answer, but the door swung open at her touch. Lisette started to call out again, but her voice froze in her throat. She recognized the tune she heard, and she knew this room. When she entered the bedroom, she could no more alter her actions than she could control the course of her dreams. It was a large bedroom, entirely furnished in the mode of the late Victorian period. The windows were curtained, and the room's only light came from a candle upon a night table beside the huge four-poster bed. An antique gold pocket watch lay upon the night table also, and the watch was chiming an old music box tune. Lisette crossed the room, praying that this was no more than another vivid recurrence of her nightmare. She reached the night table and saw that the watch's hands pointed towards midnight. The chime stopped. She picked up the watch and examined the picture that she knew would be inside the watch case. The picture was a photograph of herself. Lisette let the watch clatter onto the table, stared in hot terror at the four-poster bed. From within, a hand drew back the curtains. Lisette wished she could scream, could awaken. Sweeping aside the curtain, the occupant of the bed sat up and gazed at her. And Lisette stared back at herself. "Can't you drive a bit faster than this?" Inspector Bradley resisted the urge to wink at Detective Sergeant Wharton. "Sit back, Dr. Magnus. We'll be there in good time. I trust you'll have rehearsed some apologies for when we disrupt a peaceful household in the middle of the night." "I only pray such apologies will be necessary," Dr. Magnus said, continuing to sit forward, as if that would inspire the driver to go faster. It hadn't been easy, Dr. Magnus reflected. He dared not tell them the truth. He suspected that Bradley had agreed to making a late-night call on Beth Garrington, more to check on his alibi than from any credence he gave to Magnus's improvised tale. Buried all day in frenzied research, Dr. Magnus hadn't listened to the news, had ignored the tawdry London tabloids with their lurid headlines. Naked beauty slashed in tub, nude model slain in bath, party girl suicide or Ripper's victim. The shock of learning of Danielle's death was seconded by the shock of discovering that he was one of the important leads police were following. It had taken all his powers of persuasion to convince them to release him, or at least to accompany him to the house in Maida Vale. Ironically, he and Lisette were the only ones who could account for each other's presence elsewhere at the time of Danielle's death. While the CID might have been skeptical as to the nature of their late-night session at Dr. Magnus's office, there was a few corroborating details. A barman at the Catherine Wheel had remembered the distinguished gent with the beard leaving after his lady friend had dropped off of a sudden. The cleaning lady had heard voices and left his office undisturbed. This much they'd already checked in verifying Lisette's whereabouts that night. Half a dozen harassed records clerks could testify as to Dr. Magnus's presence for today. Dr. Magnus grimly reviewed the results of his research. There was an Elizabeth Beresford, born in London in 1879, a well-to-do family who lived in Cheyne Row on the Chelsea Embankment. Elizabeth Beresford married a Captain Donald Stapledon in 1899 and moved to India with her husband. She returned to London, evidently suffering from consumption contracted while abroad, and died in 1900. She was buried in Highgate Cemetery. That much Dr. Magnus had initially learned with some difficulty. From that basis, he had pressed on for additional corroborating details, both from Lisette's released memories and from research into records of the period. It had been particularly difficult to trace the subsequent branches of the family, something he must do in order to establish that Elizabeth Beresford could not have been an ancestress of Lisette Sayrig, and it disturbed him that he had been unable to locate Elizabeth Stapleton, near Beresford's tomb in Highgate Cemetery. Last night, he had pushed Lisette as relentlessly as he dared. Out of her resurfacing visions of horror, he finally found the clue. These were not images from nightmare, not symbolic representations of buried fears. They were literal memories. Because of the sensation involved and the considerable station of the families concerned, public records had discreetly avoided reference to the tragedy, as had the better newspapers. The yellow journals were less reticent, and here Dr. Magnus began to know fear. Elizabeth Stapleton had been buried alive. At her final wishes, the body had not been embalmed. The paper suggested that this was a clear premonition of her fate, and quoted passages from Edgar Allan Poe. Captain Stapleton paid an evening visit to his wife's tomb and discovered her wandering in a dazed condition about the graves. This was more than a month after the entombment. The newspapers were full of pseudoscientific theories, spiritualist explanations, and long accounts of Indian mystics who had remained in a state of suspended animation for weeks on end. No one seems to have explained exactly how Elizabeth Stapleton escaped from both coffin and crypt, but it was supposed that desperate strength had wrenched loose the screws while providentially the crypt had not been properly locked after a previous visit. Husband and wife understandably went abroad immediately afterward in order to escape publicity and for Elizabeth Stapleton to recover from her ordeal. This she very quickly did, but evidently the shock was more than Captain Stapleton could endure. He died in 1902, and his wife returned to London soon after, inheriting his extensive fortune and properties, including their house in Maida Vale. When she later inherited her own family's estate, her sole brother fell in the Boer War. She was a lady of great wealth. Elizabeth Stapleton became one of the most notorious hostesses of the Edwardian era, and on until the close of the First World War. Her beauty was considered remarkable, and men marveled while her rivals bemoaned that she scarcely seemed to age with the passing years. After the war, she left London to travel about the exotic East. In 1924, news came of her death in India. Her estate passed to her daughter, Jane Stapleton, born abroad in 1901. While Elizabeth Stapleton made occasional references to her daughter, Jane was raised and educated in Europe and never seemed to have come to London until her arrival in 1925. Some have suggested that the mother had wished to keep her daughter pure from her own bohemian lifestyle, but when Jane Stapleton appeared, it seemed more likely that her mother's motives for her seclusion had been born of jealousy. Jane Stapleton had all her mother's beauty. Indeed, her older admirers vowed she was the very image of Elizabeth in her youth. She also had inherited her mother's taste for wild living, with a new circle of friends from her own age group. She took up where her mother had left off. The newspapers were particularly scandalized by her association with Aleister Crowley and others of the circle. Although her dissipations bridged the years of flaming youth to the lost generation, even her enemies had to admit she carried her years extremely well. In 1943, Jane Stapleton was missing and presumed dead after an air raid leveled and burned a section of London where she had gone to dine with friends. Papers in the hands of her solicitor left her estate to a daughter living in America, Julia Weatherford, born in Miami in 1934. Evidently, her mother had enjoyed a typical whirlwind resort romance with an American millionaire while wintering in Florida. Their marriage was a secret one, annulled following Julia's birth, and her daughter had been left with her former husband. Julia Weatherford arrived from the States early in 1946. Any doubts as to the authenticity of her claim were instantly banished, for she was the very picture of her mother in her younger days. Julia again seemed to have the family's wild streak, and she carried on the tradition of wild parties and bizarre acquaintances through the beat generation to the flower children. Her older friends thought it amazing that Julia, in a mini-dress, might easily be mistaken as being of the same age group as her young pot-smoking hippie friends, but it may have been that at last her youth began to fade, because since 1967 Julia Weatherford had been living more or less in seclusion in Europe, occasionally visited by her niece. Her niece, Beth Garrington, born in 1950, was the orphan daughter of Julia's American half-sister and a wealthy young Englishman from Julia's collection. After her parents' death in a plane crash in 1970, Beth had become her aunt's protege and carried on the mad life in London. It was apparent that Beth Garrington would inherit her aunt's property as well. It was also apparent that she was the spitting image of her Aunt Julia when the latter was her age. It would be most interesting to see the two of them together, and that, of course, no one had ever done. At first, Dr. Magnus had been unwilling to accept the truth of the dread secret he had uncovered, and yet, with the knowledge of Lisette's released memories, he knew there could be no other conclusion. It was astonishing how thoroughly a woman who thrived on notoriety could avoid having her photographs published. After all, changing fashions and new hairstyles, careful adjustments with cosmetics could only do so much, and while the mind's eye had an accurate memory, a camera lens did not. Dr. Magnus did succeed in finding a few photographs through persistent research. Given a good theatrical costume and makeup crew, they all might have been taken of the same woman on the same day. They might also have all been taken of Lisette Seybrig. However, Dr. Magnus knew that it would be possible to see Beth Garrington and Lisette Seybrig together, and he prayed he would be in time to prevent this. With this knowledge tormenting his thoughts, it was a miracle that Dr. Magnus had held onto sanity well enough to persuade New Scotland Yard to make this late-night drive to Maida Vale. Desperate in view of what he knew to be true, he had suffered a shock as severe as any that night when they told him at last where Lisette had gone. "She's quite all right. She's staying with a friend." "Might I ask where?" "A chauffeur Rolls picked her up. We checked registration, and it belongs to a Miss Elizabeth Garrington in Maida Vale." Dr. Magnus had been frantic then, had demanded that they take him there instantly. A telephone call informed them that Miss Seybrig was sleeping under sedation and could not be disturbed. She would return his call in the morning. Controlling his panic, Dr. Magnus had managed to contrive a disjointed tangle of half-truths and plausible lies, anything to convince them to get over to the Garrington house as quickly as possible. They already knew he was one of those occult kooks. Very well, he assured them that Beth Garrington was involved in a secret society of drug fiends and Satanists, all true enough, that Danielle and Lisette had been lured to their most recent orgy for unspeakable purposes. Lisette had been secretly drugged, but Danielle had escaped to carry her roommate home before they could be used for whatever depraved rites awaited them, perhaps ritual sacrifice. Danielle had been murdered, either to shut her up or as part of the ritual, and now they had Lisette in their clutches as well. All very melodramatic, but enough of it was true. Inspector Bradley knew the sex and drugs orgy that took place there, but there was firm pressure from higher up to look the other way. Further, he knew enough about some of the more bizarre cult groups in London to consider that ritual murder was quite feasible given the proper combination of sick minds and illegal drugs. And while it hadn't been made public, the medical examiner was of the opinion that the slashes to the Borland girl's throat and wrist had been an attempt to disguise the fact that she had already bled to death from two deep punctures through the jugular vein. A demented killer, obviously. A ritual murder? You couldn't discount it just yet. Inspector Bradley had ordered a car. "Who are you, Lisette Seybrig, that you wear my face?" Beth Garrington rose sinuously from her bed. She was dressed in an off-the-shoulder nightgown of antique lace, much the same as that which Lisette wore. Her green eyes, the eyes behind the mask that had so shaken Lisette when they last met, held her in their spell. "When first faithful Adrian swore he'd seen my double, I thought his brain had begun to reel with final madness. But after he followed you to your little gallery and brought me there to see your portrait, I knew I had encountered something beyond even my experience." Lisette stood frozen with dread fascination at her nightmare come to life. Her twin paced about, appraising her coolly as a serpent considers its hypnotized victim. "Who are you, Lisette Seybrig, that yours is the face I have seen in my dreams, the face that haunted my nightmares as I lay dying, the face that I thought was my own?" Lisette forced her lips to speak. "Who are you?" "My name? I change that whenever it becomes prudent for me to do so. Tonight I am Beth Garrington. Long ago I was Elizabeth Beresford." How can this be possible? Lisette hoped she was dealing with a madwoman, but knew her hope was false. A spirit came to me in my dreams and slowly stole away my mortal life, in return giving me eternal life. You understand what I say, even though your reason insists that such things cannot be. She unfastened Lisette's gown and let it fall to the floor, then did the same with her own. Standing face to face, their nude bodies seemed one a reflection of the other. Lisette took Lisette's face in her hands and kissed her full on the lips. The kiss was a long one. Her breath was cold in Lisette's mouth. When Elizabeth released her lips and gazed longingly into her eyes, Lisette saw the pointed fangs that now curved downward from her upper lip. "Will you cry out, I wonder? If so, let it be in ecstasy and not in fear. I shan't drain you and discard you as I did your silly friend. No, Lisette, my newfound sister, I shall take your life in tiny kisses from night to night, kisses that you will long for with your entire being, and in the end you shall pass over to serve me as my willing chattel, as have the few others I have chosen over the years." Lisette trembled beneath her touch, powerless to break away. From the buried depths of her unconscious mind, understanding slowly emerged. She did not resist when Elizabeth led her to the bed and lay down beside her on the silken sheets. Lisette was past knowing fear. Elizabeth stretched her naked body upon Lisette's warmer flesh, lying between her thighs as would a lover. Her cool fingers caressed Lisette. Her kisses teased a path from her belly, across her breast, and to the hollow of her throat. Elizabeth paused and gazed into Lisette's eyes. Her fangs gleamed with the reflection of the inhuman lust in her expression. "And now I give you a kiss sweeter than any passion your mortal brain dare imagine, Lisette Seyrig. Even as once I first received such a kiss from a dream spirit whose eyes stared into mine from my own face. Why have you haunted my dreams, Lisette Seyrig?" Lisette returned her gaze silently without emotion, nor did she flinch when Elizabeth's lips closed tightly against her throat, and the only sound was a barely perceptible tearing, like the bursting of a maidenhead, and the soft movement of suctioning lips. Elizabeth suddenly broke away with an articulate cry of pain, her lips smeared with scarlet. She stared down at Lisette in bewildered fear. Lisette, blood streaming from the wound on her throat, stared back at her with a smile of unholy hatred. "What are you, Lisette Seyrig?"
"I am Elizabeth Beresford."
Lisette's tone was implacable. "In another lifetime, you drove my soul from my body and stole my flesh for your own. Now I have come back to reclaim that which was once mine." Elizabeth sought to leap away, but Lisette's arm embraced her with sudden terrible strength, pulling their naked bodies together in a horrid imitation of two lovers at the moment of ecstasy. The scream that echoed into the night was not one of ecstasy. At the sound of the scream, afterward they never agreed whether it was two voices together or only one. Inspector Bradley ceased listening to the maid's outraged protest and burst past her into the house. "Upstairs, on the double," he ordered needlessly. Already Dr. Magnus had lunged past him and was sprinting up the stairway. "I think it came from the next floor up. Check inside all the rooms." Later he cursed himself for not posting a man at the door, for by the time he was again able to think rationally, there was no trace of the servants. In the master bedroom at the end of the third floor hallway, they found two bodies behind the curtains of the big four-poster bed. One had only just been murdered. Her nude body was drenched in the blood from her torn throat, seemingly far too much blood for one body. The other body was a desiccated corpse, obviously dead for a great many years. The dead girl's limbs obscenely embraced the moldering cadaver that lay atop her, and her teeth in final spasm were locked in the lich's throat. As they gaped in horror, clumps of hair and bits of dried blood could be seen to drop away. Detective Sergeant Wharton looked away and vomited on the floor. "I owe you a sincere apology, Dr. Magnus." Inspector Bradley's face was grim. "You were right. Ritual murder by a gang of sick degenerates. Detective Sergeant, leave off that and put on all points bulletin for Beth Garrington, and round up anyone else you find here. Move, man!"
"If only I'd understood in time," Dr. Magnus muttered. He was obviously at the point of collapse. "No,
I should have listened to you sooner," Bradley growled. "We might have been in time to prevent this. The devils must have fled down some servant's stairway when they heard us burst in. I confess I've bungled this badly."
"She was a vampire, you see,"
Dr. Magnus told them dully, groping to explain. "A vampire loses its soul when it becomes one of the undead. But the soul is deathless. It lives on even when its previous incarnation has become a soulless demon. Elizabeth Beresford's soul lived on until Elizabeth Beresford found reincarnation in Lisette Sayrig. Don't you see? Elizabeth Beresford met her own reincarnation, and that meant destruction for them both." Inspector Bradley had been only half listening. "Dr. Magnus, you've done all you can. I think you should go down to the car with Detective Sergeant Wharton now and rest until the ambulance arrives."
"But you must see that I was right," Dr. Magnus pleaded, madness dancing in his eyes. "If the soul is immortal and infinite, then time has no meaning for the soul. Elizabeth Beresford was haunting herself."